13-24-00181-CB in the estate of Georgia Gail Arnold, deceased.
Your Honors, we are here this morning to represent Donna Shook, the trustee of the Georgia Arnold Trust. We come before this court today to appeal a judgment from the trial court that resulted in a sanction awarding $60,000 of attorney's fees to a Michael Arnold, who contested the trust. This case began with the passing of Georgia Arnold on April the 3rd, 2021. At that time, shortly after that time in June, an heirship application was filed by Mr. Michael Arnold, who is the nephew of the deceased. This heirship
was before the application to probate the will was filed.
Correct? That is correct, Your Honor. That is correct. This heirship application had material omissions or misstatements. There had, in fact, been a will that was recorded by Miss Georgia Arnold before her passing, and this will had not been presented for probate at the time that the heirship application was submitted. We believe that Mr. Michael Arnold had knowledge of that will. There's some evidence that there was knowledge of the will, and in spite of that being the case, an heirship was filed in order to make Mr. Michael Arnold a litigant.
What evidence do you have that he knew that the last will and testament?
Your Honor, there was an email that was sent from Mr. Arnold to our client asking where the will was located at the time that the heirship, actually before the heirship was being submitted. Now, in the heirship application itself, these are fairly standard. There are questions on whether a will was there. And actually, one of the questions asking whether there was existence of a will was simply deleted on the application. So,
well,
our.
When you said there was an email where he asked if there was a will, did he get a response?
He was asking for where the will was located, Your Honor. And that response was then forwarded to us as representative, and then we began to engage with attorneys for Mr. Arnold at that point in time. So the question was, where is the will located? Not, is there a will here? So we believe that this case began in bad faith by the filing of an heirship application when, in fact, Mr. Michael Arnold knew that a will was in existence. After the heirship application was filed in, then my client came in and filed the will for probate. At the time that that was done, the case was then consolidated with the to bring the probate in with the heirship, but jurisdiction was never recorded properly for this case to begin with because the original court of jurisdiction, excuse me, the trial court that provided the judgment we're asking an appeal for was the one that was the heirship trial court. So the probate was filed in and consolidated, but jurisdiction was never established properly after the year.
Wasn't it Ms. Shook who requested the consolidation?
We requested the consolidation. That is correct, Your Honor. But the trial court jurisdiction was never reestablished to allow for orders in this case. And that's the first basis of our appeal. We have, I believe, six issues we presented for this body this morning. And two of them relate to the proper jurisdiction on this case. So an heirship application was filed with omissions. We filed a will, my client filed a will for probate. Those were consolidated, but the proper jurisdiction to award the probate court was never done. And the trial court continued with the jurisdiction that they originally had to provide the orders that followed. And that's, of course, what we're appealing on this case this morning. That was how this case began.
All that hinges then on whether or not the appellee, knew that there was a will before.
Certainly in terms of whether there was good faith, Your Honor, that's absolutely accurate. But the fact is that when an heirship is filed and then a probate of a will is filed, the heirship can no longer have jurisdiction. When a will is presented, the purpose of an heirship goes away because it presumes that the testator would have died intestate. And that's...
Wasn't there another action brought after that?
Another action, Your Honor?
Contesting the will?
Yes. So subsequent to the filing of the probate, then later there was a contest of the will that was presented. That contest, of course, was filed by Mr. Michael Arnold on general grounds of incapacity on one side, and then grounds also that there was some inappropriate coercion that occurred as well. Both of those two grounds were then filed without much support. Now, to take this further, Ms. Shook, Donna Shook is the trustee for the Georgia Arnold Trust. Her duty as the trustee surrounds confidentiality of the trust device that she's protecting. She has a duty to keep the privacy of her client. In regards to this particular contest, this being filed by a nephew who was disinherited by his aunt, a nephew out of state. What, in fact, the trust device did was to deliver property to the effective spouse that Miss Arnold had, an older gentleman that she lived with. It was Miss Shook's belief that it was particularly important to protect the privacy of her desire to leave her assets to her live-in boyfriend, in effect, than it was to leave it to a nephew out of state that she did not have contact with. So there's the concept of a general privacy that she needed to protect. There's also specific privacy being protected to not have a nephew interfere with this relationship that Miss Arnold had maintained. So both of those were in effect in this case. When the trial court was then motioned by Mr. Arnold to compel the discovery of the trust, that is the turnover of the trust device. Very important point here. The trust device was offered in camera to the trial court. So as of 2021, the trial court had the trust device in their possession that entire time because it had been offered for in-camera examination.
At what point?
This was in 2021, Your Honor, and this is actually in September of 2021. So when the appeal went forward, and the appeal was, which went up to this body and then on to the Supreme Court, that appeal was on the basis that without a legitimate contest or a legitimate litigant, the privacy of the trust should be maintained.
And let me ask you, I looked at that opinion that came before or was issued by our court, and it was noted that, you know, the court didn't grant the mandamus relief because there were no documents provided that for them to even make the determination if they were privileged. Why were those documents also not provided to the Court of Appeals?
Your Honor, are you speaking about the trust being provided in camera?
Yes.
I don't know that I have an answer for that, but I do know that the trust had been offered up to the trial court. And at no point, I don't think, was our client ever unwilling to share the trust with any appropriate courts of jurisdiction. What she was attempting to do, of course, was protect the privacy of the trust for her client versus this out-of-state and basically a spurned nephew who had been disinherited. That was her intent, to protect that privacy particularly during the action.
My understanding is that you rely on a post-order Supreme Court opinion, a concurrence, with only two of the justices joining in that concurrence that happened afterwards. And the appellees in this case assert that it just absolutely wasn't the law in the state of Texas at the time.
It was a case of first impression, Your Honors. Now, it is a very widespread common law in other jurisdictions, and consultation was given to some very important bodies and persons, including Jerry Beyer, on whether this would be a valuable contest. It certainly was, in our opinion, a very valid effort to protect the privacy and fulfilling the fiduciary duties that the trustee had to the trust. The Supreme Court opinion later, with the two concurrents that you speak of, that was after this case came back before the trial court and the sanctions were granted, but nonetheless definitely gives strong footing to the idea that privacy for trusts in Texas was an important and valid concept that we were pursuing. So that appeals process played out for about 1 year's time. And at the conclusion of that time, we went back before the trial court after the mandamus was denied. And at that point, the trial court saw fit to grant all of the attorney's fees, about $60,000, to Mr. Michael Arnold. Now, three of our issues before this court surround the assessment of that award, particularly because it was structured as a discovery sanction, when in fact, in the words of the trial court judge themselves, this was a form of, in effect, an appraisal that was being done against the fact that we were using the appeals process. He stated that himself in the transcript, which is to say that because he didn't feel that this was a valid challenge, he saw fit to convert the attorney's fees into a sanction that could be granted to the other party, which is a most considerable concession that we would have to make. So that's an important part of our case this morning, is that it was improper for the trial court to convert their feeling that it was a groundless and meritless appeal into a form of discovery sanction against our client, when, in fact, the trust had been in the possession, in camera possession of the trial court the entire time. That was an inappropriate assessment, and in effect was a way for the trial court to hold it against my client that we decided to use the appeals process for a legitimate issue. And this was unjust. It was improper under the rules being cited to award that amount of money. Now, it's important also to look at the following events. After the case came back before the trial court, this is now we're talking about in late 2022, discovery was exchanged. Very little discovery was ever provided by the contestant, Mr. Michael Arnold, to the point to where the trial court was needing to compel answers from them. They lost one of the two summary judgments. The trial court granted one of those two summary judgments to us. And then 1 week before trial, they withdrew their case via a non-suit. And the reason I wanted to point out the totality of this case to this body is because it's evidence that it was not a legitimate contest. Mr. Michael Arnold did not have a legitimate reason to contest that. And that is why he withdrew his case, why he lost one of the two summary judgments, and why he withdrew his case, which is to substantiate the protection of privacy that Ms. Donna Shook was attempting to do in favor of her client, which is to protect that from an illegitimate contest that was being filed. And they, in my opinion, in a great display of bad faith, withdrew that contest just before trial. So it's important to look at all of that. Now, at the same time that the non-suit was being effected, the trial court also had signed an order stating that the order awarding the $60,000 as a discovery sanction was final at the time that it was issued. We take firm opposition to this as well. The action was never properly severed in any way to be a final order. And until the entire case was disposed with via the non-suit, that order was never final, allowing us to appear before this body in order to appeal, which we did in a timely fashion.
In a probate case, at the trial court level, is it necessary to sever that and create a new cause number like you would in another civil case?
That is one thing you can do. In probate cases, there is an exception where it is possible to have certain actions, if they're completely resolved, to be standing orders. None of those criteria were met. All of that we've briefed thoroughly into the brief we provided for this court. So that was none of those conditions, nor was a severance ever provided to make that order final. And we certainly believe it was inappropriate for the trial court to 2 years later go back and say that that should have been a final order.
Is it your position then that you were waiting for some other type of finality in order to appeal the $60,000 attorney sanction or attorney's fee sanction?
Absolutely.
So, and it wasn't until they filed the motion to confirm the order that you appealed. I guess it begs the question, did you appeal the order confirming or the original order? Because you would have been out of time.
Right. Well, it would be the order confirming, but because no elements of the case were ever final until the non-suit was executed, that's when our appeals window started. So for the judge to, at that same time when he's disposing of the case, in opening the window, cannot go back at that time and then say that an order from 2 years earlier was properly severed and final at the same time. So the execution of their non-suit, their withdrawal of all of their claims and contests was the time at which all of the orders would have gone final for appeal.
And discovery continued after the Supreme Court denied the mandamus?
Yes, it
what
did.
What type of discovery was happening after that?
And most of the discovery was based around the contest that Mr. Arnold was placing against the will that was presented for probate on the basis of both incapacity and undue influence. So asking for support for that. No production was ever turned over. And the only thing that really was turned over was an affidavit from Mr. Arnold himself, which was frankly, an affidavit with a lot of very compromised language on his belief that because she didn't award her estate to him, she must have had a loss of capacity.
And that was after the Supreme Court denied their writ.
Yes, it was, Your Honor. See, I'm running out of time, and I had nothing further unless Your Honors have any further questions at this time.
Real quick, there's four categories of fiduciary duties recognized by common law. It's duty of loyalty, duty of competence, duty to exercise discretion of the relating to the trust property, and duty of full disclosure. Where would duty of privacy come in? Where would that fall?
It's under duty of confidence in our assessment, Your Honor. Confidence not only for the trustee, but to not reveal the trust contents to an inappropriate party.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ready?
Here's your honor. May it please the court. Obviously, we have a very different interpretation of the situation of the trial court. Appellant presented six issues. I will address them all in turn, or I'm prepared to address them all in turn. But as noted in our brief, I can distill this into 2 points. And the first being that jurisdiction existed at all levels of this. There was never a formal challenge to jurisdiction brought forth in the trial court. The trial court entered, as Your Honors noted, its order consolidating the two matters together prior to the order on the subpoena being issued. I'm not clear on how we jump to they did not have subpoena power after the consolidation. Based on the motion that they filed. So point number one, jurisdiction existed at all levels here. The second point being the October 4th, 2022 order on sanctions, the $60,000, that was final and appealable upon entry, okay? So the deadline to appeal that has long since passed. The February 29th, 2024 order clarifying that that order was final upon entry was merely an unequivocal clarification by the trial court that was made necessary by the appellant's refusal to acknowledge or pay or deal with the order at the time. The appellant's contention that the order was void and unenforceable should have been made in a proper appeal on October 5th of 2022, or you catch my drift.
So are you saying that the order confirming the previous order of the $60,000 is not an appealable order? Because the previous order was filed, and you know the dates, I can't remember the dates. Even if it was a final appealable, there's nothing to appeal because the $60,000 sanction was issued previously and would have been a final appeal.
Yes, to put a fine point on it, whether or not the February 29th, 2024 clarification on finality, whether or not that is final and appealable, does not change that it didn't. The February order did not make the October 2022 order final. It was final and appealable, and the court, this ended up with a lot of.
Therefore, your contention that they missed the deadline.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. The clarification that it was finality upon signature did not ratify it in February. It just clarified the judge's intent. The judge affirmatively stated in that order, the October 2022 order was final when I signed it. Stop arguing about it. That's all the February 2024 order confirming finality says. And it became necessary to file the motion and proposed order confirming finality because this was such an obvious thing to us that was being treated like an interlocutory order.
There is a test that determines whether or not a discovery order, and John, you might have to help me out here, to whether a discovery order in a probate matter is final and appealable. And I think it was a substantially material issue is one of those. Are you following me on that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would this be one of those issues?
Certainly. And another way to look at it, is it a case discussing Crosum? But yes, the substantial portion, but also a way that it is framed is could it be a standalone claim? Because in the case that you're discussing, that talks about the law, there was some order that would not have been able to be a standalone claim. The sanctions order is very much tantamount to a standalone claim. Put another way, if this case was litigated out and decided in favor of Donna Shook, they still would have had to pay that sanctions order. If the contrary is to be assumed, if they litigated the case and somehow won at trial, that would not nullify the court's own order on sanctions for a narrow, distinct, discrete issue.
But that talks about when it's appealable. On page 12 of your brief, you said that the order was final and appealable, but you have no citation to direct me to, and I've been trying to find out where you come up with that conclusion, because in probate, some things are final and appealable and some things aren't, and there's really, it's hard to determine that. So is there case law that says that a discovery order sanction in probate is a final appealable order?
No, sir. It's we rely on that separate, discrete, distinct, those buzzwords from Lehman v. Harcom and Lehman v. Harcon and I don't have them in front of me. I don't want to butcher it, Your Honor. But no, sir, to answer your question clearly, there is no law on point saying this type of sanction order is a discrete issue for the final multiple final judgment.
And when I look to the rules of civil procedure 215.3 dealing with sanctions for abuse of discovery, it says such orders of sanctions shall be subject to review on appeal from the final judgment. So discovery orders in a regular case are appealable from the final judgment of a regular case, and discovery happens in every probate, but there's no case law saying a discovery sanction order in probate is a final appealable order.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Correct.
So how would an attorney know if there's no case law and there's no statute?
I would say we based our assertion on our interpretation of the language in the multiple final judgment rule.
Okay.
Because the sanctions issue was a standalone issue, because the order granting sanctions put a period on the end of everything dealing with that narrow issue, we believe it falls under the common law language. But I will not sit here and tell Your Honor that that order is enumerated somewhere in Texas case law or Texas jurisprudence. This is based on our reading and understanding of what a separate, discrete issue is. Thank you, Your Honor. Other points worth noting: appellant argues that the heirship application wasn't sworn, so the court lacked jurisdiction. The appellee's application to appoint independent administrator did meet all the statutory requirements. So to say that even if, and there was no finding that this pleading was deficient, but even if there was a finding that one pleading was deficient or it was struck, that doesn't nullify the jurisdiction of the court. The pursuant to Nueces County Local Rule 3, the consolidation was mandatory based on the language shall consolidate. Appellant mischaracterized the sanctions award. We initially requested $90,000. The court reduced that to $60,000. Second, it was not a sanctions award because of the mandamus. It was also for the appellee's repeated attempts to procure the trust. It was also for the subpoena, the request for production, and the numerous hearings on the issue. After the court had ordered it produced to the appellee, they produced it in camera. They still didn't produce it to the appellee till later on.
So some of the attorney's fees that were awarded were not part of the appeal?
They were part of the appeal, but also things associated with the subject matter of the appeal, i.e. the efforts to procure the trust pursuant to the court's order to produce the trust.
They complained somewhere in the brief that the court erred because they gave you unconditional contingent appellate attorney's fee. In their brief. But I'm wondering whether or not that means whether you were unsuccessful in the mandamus or whether you'd be unsuccessful here today. You understand?
I do understand what you're saying, and I don't want to speculate as to their motives. I would just say, and this gets to...
my question is, because in the mandamus proceedings, you did prevail.
Correct.
So would it matter then whether they prevail now today, whether you're going to get your $60,000 or not?
Well,
I guess if they did prevail, you wouldn't get your $60,000.
Well, on their arguments, if you bought the black and white of their contentions, that is what they're arguing. We disagree. We disagree that the order of sanctions is even appealable at this point. Again, the appellant's reply brief breaks down the six issues into three portions: issue one and two on jurisdiction, issue 3, 4, 5 on the order itself, and then issue number 6 on the validity of an order, on the order confirming finality. And so I'd just like to give your honors a few notes on that. Okay. Appellant's issue 1, did the trial court have jurisdiction over Michael W. Arnold and the heirship proceeding on November 10th, 2021, when the second amended order on motion to compel with subpoena was signed? So appellant conflates jurisdiction to make a final heirship determination with the jurisdiction to order a subpoena after the consolidation of the matters. Those are not the same thing. Those are not the same things by a wide margin. It was never litigated. There was never a final heirship determination. That point was never litigated. The consolidation occurred long before that would have, and it turned out that there was a will, right? So that was never going to happen. But jurisdiction to issue a final heirship determination is not jurisdiction to order a subpoena after the consolidation. So that's a false equivalency. The appellant's contention that the appellee did not invoke the trial court's jurisdiction on the basis to the application to determine heirship, as I mentioned, is unconvincing, because we also filed an application for letters of dependent administration that was not challenged, that comported with every bit of Texas Estates Code 301.052, referencing contents for application for letters of administration. So again, even if that one pleading had a defect, there was never a finding on that, that was not the only pleading filed in the heirship. The second issue on jurisdiction, the trial court did not have jurisdiction to sign the November 10th, 2021 order. Therefore, was it an error of law to sign the order on sanctions? So the appellant in addressing this issue contends that Michael Arnold did not become a party subject to the trial court's jurisdiction until he filed his will contest. So there's nothing in the court's record to support that contention. There was no challenge on that basis, no jurisdictional challenge on that basis. But it's important to notice, as we've discussed, the subpoena was issued after the consolidation. So I don't understand the argument that after the consolidation, the court can't issue a subpoena to order the production of a document that's at issue to a person interested in the estate. The issues on the sanctions order, the October 2022 order, issues 3, 4, and 5. So on issue 3 is about the substantially justified language in Rule 215.2b8. So that rule requires a finding of substantial justification. So that did not occur at the trial court. Of course, the contention is that y'all can make a finding that they were substantially justified at this level. I believe that's the contention he's making. But just let it be clear, there was no finding of substantial justification. So that language in the statute is as of yet unsatisfied. The appellant withheld the trust in spite of the court's order, in the absence of any applicable law to do so. Now, there was a reference of broad support in common law in other jurisdictions. That's the whole point, that there was never a valid argument made on that. There was never briefing about Rhode Island law and New York law. There was no support for the argument that there was a common law duty to preserve the confidentiality of the trust, except the two justice concurrence that was published 3 weeks after the order was rendered. So again, to say that there was a leg to stand on there, we vehemently disagree now, as we did in the trial court. And I think that the record and the weight of Texas law supports us on that, on the common law duty of confidentiality.
How about their contention that ultimately you withdrew your contest and withdrew all your pleadings and non-suited, and that would make it somehow unjust and unfair to issue a sanction award of $60,000 in this case.
The sanctions award was final for 2 years when we filed that. They can't now make that argument, number one. Number two, I resent the contention that a strategic non-suit was somehow dispositive of the merits of our case. That's an inappropriate way to frame that. So I would just say, Your Honor, that cannot serve to invalidate an order that we contend was final upon signing in 2022.
Two things that I'd like to mention, because you're saying that there was no basis for their argument, but even in your brief on page 11, you're talking about the common law fiduciary duties of loyalty, competence, discretion, and disclosure. So you don't think that would fall under any of that, just making sure the general public or somebody that doesn't have an interest in a trust estate preventing them from getting information?
No, certainly not. And we did a deep dive on this, right? We wanted to be prepared for that. And I can't find support for that, even in the scholarly reading that we did on this. No, I don't believe that an explicit duty of confidentiality, well, certainly an explicit duty doesn't exist. I don't think that those core duties even frame an implicit duty for confidentiality, because we all know that sometimes trusts are published, right? And when we write trusts, there's not explicit language about waiver and publication and confidentiality as a general rule. So certainly I don't find an explicit or implicit duty in the core duties of the trustee.
Okay. Then also when talking about sanctions, one of the issues that need to be taken into consideration is the prejudice of the conduct. And I don't see any briefing on prejudice when the trust was produced to the court in camera. How is them asserting a potential defense to production? How did that harm the? You understand where I'm going?
Yes, Your Honor. I would say the trial court's logic on prejudice, and I wasn't involved in that portion of the argument to the trial court, but I would say the trial court's logic on prejudice was it was such a spurious claim. It was ordered to be produced from the beginning. There was no support in law that it severely cost and prejudiced our client to fight such a black and white battle that had no support in the law. That is the impression I took from the trial court.
So there was no litigious prejudice, or just maybe a cost of fighting it.
I don't want to speculate in that regard. I would certainly say that's the harmful result, Your Honor. I know I'm almost out of time. I would just jump to issue 6 on the abuse of discretion on the order to confirm finality. There's no better clarification of a trial court's intent than an unequivocal finding flatly declaring that intent. That's the point of the February order confirming finality. The order was final when it was entered. The order confirming finality does not impart finality at a later date. It confirms the order was final when the court entered it. The appellant questioned the finality of the order, and the trial court clarified. A claim that the court had no authority to answer this question is baseless. On the basis of that challenge to the order awarding sanctions, a challenge to the order awarding sanctions is untimely and cannot now be brought. The October 4th, 2022 order disposed of a distinct singular issue analogous to a separate claim. The appellant's remedy, a remedy that they did not exercise, was a direct and timely appeal. And I would yield the rest of my time to questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Any questions?
I do. I agree that the judge writing in on the subsequent order that it was intended to be a final order. But his intent really, I don't know that is part of the analysis on whether he intended it for it to be final. I think 215.3 in a regular case says it's not final until reviewable until a final judgment. disposing of all parties and all issues. On probate issues, it says it has to dispose of all issues and all parties in the phase of the proceeding for which it was brought. And I'm having trouble seeing discovery as each question being an independent phase as opposed to discovery as a phase. Can you help me on that?
Yes, Your Honor, if you don't mind me using a few extra seconds. So the point my partner makes ties into this, and that's the October 4th order was issued prior to the mandamus. The mandamus was filed in November of 22. So it didn't include fees for the mandamus. I think it's relevant. And to answer your question, this was not about discovery abuse. Generally, this was not about flaws in RFPs and INTs. It was a narrow singular issue that was the production of a singular trust instrument. And so because there were no remaining issues, because there was not an overall abuse of process in bad faith request for admit or something like that, failure to produce, it wasn't a sanction based on the general nebulous process of discovery. It was a sanction based on the production of a single instrument. And so, as I said earlier, it puts a period on that sentence. That's why it's different.
Thank you.
Thank you kindly, Your Honor. Your Honors.
Just a couple of points, because I think Mr. King had addressed our main issues. To your point, if the court had to clarify that order, for what purpose? It goes to the question about how someone would know, attorney would know, that somehow that order a year and a half before was final, when the only existing statute regarding that kind of discovery states clearly that only upon a final judgment is it appealable. And at that point, when that order was entered, was when this process of filing a notice of appeal and so forth started, because he's saying that, the judge is saying that, and that's the order that needed to be appealed along with the prior order.
So if you're correct that the two orders, the first sanction order and then the order confirming, are not final appealable orders, you still have the $60,000 hanging out there. They've non-suited. When do you have to appeal? When does the probate end for you to appeal that? When's your finality in the process?
When he dismissed his heirship and dismissed his other claims. But if you look in the record, we didn't actually wait till then. We immediately, prematurely, were filing notices of appeal because it was such a kind of a new thing. And out of abundance of caution, we immediately started filing our notice of appeal, and it was more than one because things were happening, later. But that would be, in my opinion, when you would be able to appeal everything, would be obviously when he dismissed his case. That adjudicates everything, and it's over. If there was jurisdiction, going back to the original argument, it didn't end until he dismissed his case. And as a point of fact, all the orders that are subject to this appeal are all issued in that heirship cause number. Another important point I wanted to make was because it was a question that was asked earlier, was, when the application to probate the will was filed, it was after that the discovery request was issued as the subject of this appeal. He obviously knew there was a will because the discovery request asked for all the trust documents subject to the will. So even then, he knew when he was asking for those documents, including not just the trust documents, but any other memoranda and paperwork and so forth associated with distribution of property, et cetera, he already knew there was a will and his heirship was no good. But in the heirship proceeding, he's still asking for those documents. So the answer to the question about the evidence that he knew there was a will, he certainly knew at the time that he asked for these documents that there was a will. It was important also to note, as Justice referred to, is that This is not a typical situation where you have documents where somebody's refusing to give them and hiding them or whatever. They were produced in camera immediately. The court had them. And essentially what happened, as you can see from the brief and our position, is that the appellant was punished for exercising their right of appeal, even though they lost, but ultimately vindicated a few weeks later by the Supreme Court that the confidentiality of trust documents is something that a trustee is supposed to protect. So I think that's also important to note. And again, the only rule that we have to go by is the 215. It says that discovery sanctions are appealable only after a final judgment. Not while this mess between the heirship and the application for probate was ongoing for some period of time. Again, ultimately, the Supreme Court came back and ruled that confidentiality of these trust documents is a valid task for any trustee. The only other thing to his argument that somehow there was a final substantial adjudicated right over a discovery dispute can't hold. I mean, we have discovery disputes in all cases. It doesn't make any of that final. And in this case, I think the same thing would apply, that there was no substantial right adjudicated because of a discovery sanction. Not an equity, they deserve money because the mandamus didn't work out for appellant, but a sanction under 215. I think that's just justly unfair.
Thank you. The case will be under submission. Y'all have a good day.